And in committee, I hope we'll be joined in just a minute by, yes, we are at this moment being joined by more colleagues. Have a good day here, important day, and looking forward to it. Got a couple of things that we need to do first, and we have a work session relating to a special motion to strike. We're going to be moving a bill to another committee that suits them a bit better than us, considering our workload. And also, we're going to be introducing a committee bill today, and you see the LC draft in front of you there. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and open a work session on House Bill 2460. And Representative Doyle.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move HB 2460 without recommendation to the Judiciary Committee.
Representative Doyle moves House Bill 2460 without recommendation to the Judiciary Committee. Do we have any discussion? Any objections? All right, I will close the work session on House Bill 2460, and I will open the work session for the purpose of introducing committee bills. And I'll take a motion.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll move LC 2327 be made a committee bill.
Thank you. Representative Gardner moves LC 2327. We moved as a committee bill. Do we have any discussion? Any objection? So moved. We'll close the work session. And now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2802. And I'd like to begin today, let me say as we begin, we have a fairly full list of people who'd like to take part today, and that's wonderful. I appreciate that very much. In the consideration of time, let's just remember to make it as expeditious as possible as we work through our agenda today. I'd like to call up Secretary of State Bill Bradbury, and Bradbury, if you would go along with Al Davidson and Glenn Newkirk, please. That would be wonderful. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Bradbury, and I am the Oregon Secretary of State. In keeping with the words you just said about keeping things short, I can assure you my testimony will be less than a page. I just want to point out that this is not the first time this proposal has come before the legislature. In fact, in 1999, the proposal passed both the House and the Senate, but failed to get the funding needed to implement the system. Clearly, this year, there are significant issues with the perception of problems with the electoral system. I firmly believe that the perceptions of problems are much bigger than the actual problems, particularly here in Oregon, but I think it's critical that our elections are free and fair, but equally critical that people perceive that elections are free and fair. In light of Florida, it's essential that we elected officials do everything in our power to fully restore the public trust in our election system. What's at issue today is the Oregon Centralized Voter Registration System. And that system, if it's implemented, will go a long way to improving the perception of people of the system and the proper functioning of the system. OCVR will greatly reduce the instances of multiple registrations in Oregon. OCVR will dramatically reduce the chances that someone could vote twice, and OCVR will dramatically improve the cleanliness of the registration rolls. Now, I want to be real clear that Oregon centralized voter registration will not solve every problem with the electoral system, but it will dramatically increase public confidence in the system, and that's worth a great deal. One final note is that there are some amendments that we're going to propose. Fred Neal from the Elections Division will be proposing them a little later, and I just wanted to let you know that those are coming. They're basically technical in nature, but they will come before you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the Secretary? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Al Davidson, County Clerk for Marion County. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you on this issue today. Central voter registration system means different things to different people, and my purpose here today on behalf of the County Clerks of Oregon is to give you an idea of what it means to those of us who are responsible for voter registration in the state of clerk's perspective. The county clerks have supported a centralized voter registration system since 1990 when we adopted it in our elections futures paper. While we firmly believe that Oregon's voter registration rolls are the cleanest in the nation, made so by our consistent use of vote by mail and constant feedback that we get from the voters and the Postal Service about their addresses, we understand that there's always room for improvement, better and more timely management of voter registration, and we see a centralized voter registration system as a way of getting at that, refining the accuracy of our files and maintaining a high level of integrity. The Secretary mentioned the perception of the system, and during this last election there were a lot of rumors flying around about thousands of voters who were registered in multiple counties. I don't believe that to be true. There's been no evidence that that is true, and in fact the experience that we've had as elections officials in comparing our records one county to the other, which we have taken upon ourselves to do through private vendors in the absence of a centralized voter registration system, has shown that we have a very small incident of voters registered in multiple counties. So I think if you hear those kinds of allegations made, I think you need to make sure that you are certain of the kind of data that's being presented, the records that are being analyzed, because there, in any search of the records, there may be a large number of potential duplicates, people with the same last name perhaps, but what you will find, I think, and what our experience shows is that there are a very small number of those potential duplicates that are, in fact, registered in more than one county. We support the amendments that will be presented, which create a stronger role for county elections officials in the design and development of the system. The essential issues, as we see them, are that even with the creation of a centralized voter registration database, the function of voter registration remains a county-level responsibility, and the official voter registration record remains that at the county level. We don't think that that the system can be designed to where the state record becomes the official record. There are just always too many registration cards in the process, and so the county voter registration files must be retained as the official file. What we're essentially interested in is the creation of a statewide database so that county officials will know if someone is registered in another county. And there are a lot of other functions that can be added on to a system, and I think Mr. Newkirk will talk about some of that. But to us, those are all extraneous issues. Those are all add-ons. The basic premise that we're after is a database that we can check to see if a voter is registered in another county when we get a voter registration card from that voter. We think that the system must be adequately funded to meet the expectations, whatever those add-ons are, whatever the expectations of the system are as it comes out. The implementation must not be rushed. The state of Oregon has some experience with systems that are not properly implemented. There are a number of other states that have had serious problems with their statewide voter registration implementation projects because they have not allowed adequate time to phase them in over a period of time. The bottom line is that it must work at the county level because that's where the action is, and we have to be able to be as accurate as possible to best serve our voters. In some of the other states, they've not taken into consideration sufficiently the needs of the officials who are responsible for voter registration, and that has resulted in some other large jurisdictions pulling out of state voter registration systems in some other states. We don't want to see that happen here. We want to do the best we can to assure success. Thank you very much, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Have you take me just for a moment. Senator Brown needs your chair just for a second.
Surely.
If you do that, I'll pull you right back. Senator Brown, please.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know that I'm getting so old that I need a chair, but I sure appreciate it. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 7. Thanks for the opportunity to be here today to testify on behalf of a centralized voter registration system. I've, in fact, supported this since the idea was first introduced a couple of sessions ago, and I think we actually need to just quit talking about it and actually do it. There are a couple of reasons that I know folks have talked about today, but there are a couple of reasons I feel strongly about it. Number one, I do think that voters have to be able to have faith in our voting system and that we have to preserve the integrity of this system, and the centralized voter registration system will help maintain that. Secondly, it's also helpful in addressing the determining the double majority, the voting requirements, and I think would help us avoid some potential lawsuits. And I think it's our responsibility as legislators to take a leadership on this issue and to be proactive and prevent problems before they begin. So, and then, Mr. Chair, if I may, I just want to share, Representative Gardner remembers this story, but I won my first election by literally a handful of votes. It was 7 votes out of 7,000 in a Democratic primary. So voters need to be sure that their vote is counted and is counted accurately. And I think the centralized registration system will help take us in that direction. So thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Senator Brown? Thanks very much.
Thank you. I appreciate the courtesy.
Mr. Davidson, if you would come back and assume that chair, I appreciate it. When Mr. Davidson graciously would leave there, he asked if we would like to give him any questions. Do we have any questions for him? All right, very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Glenn Newkirk, president of InfoCentury Services. We are the firm that was contracted by the Secretary of State's office in 1998 and 1999 to carry out a needs assessment and requirements analysis for the Oregon Central Voter Registration System. After hearing the 3 people who spoke immediately before me, I think all I really need to do to give most of my testimony today is to say I told you so, because much of what we wrote in 1998 and 1999 you have heard reaffirmed here today. Specifically, and it will almost sound like it is in the exact order that you heard it, the primary advantages that we identified through our interviews and focus groups and site visits were that an OCVR could assist in reducing duplicate and multiple voter registrations, could reduce the possibility of people voting more than once, and would bring about an increase in the confidence in the voter registration and the voter administration process. The senator also addressed another very important issue, which is the potential for assisting rolls to be maintained in such a manner that would help reduce the possibility of lawsuits that being affected in the double majority voting situation. And I will say at the time we did our study in 1998 and 1999, there had just been one of those, and so people were particularly heightened to that particular aspect of what an OCVR might be able to do by helping maintain even better and more cleansed voter registration files than you already have. I also want to point out that our study, as any kind of needs assessment and requirements analysis should do, also pinpointed what perceptions were of some of the potential disadvantages that needed to be mitigated against in an OCVR. Mr. Davidson has spoken of one, and in fact it was probably the one that came to the top the fast, is that nothing should be done to lose local control over the voter registration and the election administration process. Of course, one of the other aspects, and I'm sure there will be more discussion about this, one of the other negative aspects was the potential cost of a system, because it is definitely not inexpensive to implement what is really one of the largest statewide systems that Oregon would put in, behind other systems like Department of Motor Vehicles, certainly revenue systems, and some systems you probably have in the areas of health and human services are quite large. This one would reach out and in effect touch and be touched by 36 counties. It would maintain millions of records, and it would be updated with a very high level of frequency. And that kind of system does not come inexpensively. One of the other things that we do in these studies, and again, Mr. Davison touched on these, one of the other things that we do is we like to pinpoint what we consider to be the critical success factors. What are those elements of a large information systems project that you really need to devote your resources to in order to keep it from going in the ditch? We pinpointed five of those, and these are roughly in order that we found them in 1998. Number one, acceptance by and participation in the system by Oregon's counties and election officials. Number two, support for the project among Oregon's governmental and political leadership. Number three, establishment of a realistic project schedule. Number four, stable multi-year funding that can be essentially counted on through the life of the project. And number five, the creation of a good, solid team of state staff, county officials, and the vendor community to make the project work. Those were the items that we had identified in 1998. Let me just add in this that I think the approach that is outlined, certainly with the amendments that you'll be seeing, toward spending the time up front to design it and plan it properly is a critical aspect of this. Mr. Davidson alluded to one train wreck that has occurred, and Mr. Davidson is very familiar with this one, as am I, since it happened in my home state of North Carolina. It was a situation where we did the study. We gave a cost estimate that was approximately $7 million to create the system in that state. And this was in 1995, and for various reasons, the project was delayed until 1997, at which point we had estimated 2 to 3 years to complete the project. We had estimated $7 million cost. The funding came in at $4.1 million, and the State Board of Elections was given 1 year to complete the project. They contacted us and asked us to participate in the project, and we declined. The reason is I have no interest in rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. And sure enough, that project today still has not met its original charter. It is now 3 years late, and the last cost estimate on the project was $9.1 million. So that is something you don't need. You don't need the rush. You do need the stable multi-year funding. And you do need to have a project team that can be put in place to do the appropriate planning and the refinement of the cost estimates and the refinement of the actual time schedule to get the project done and done properly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for our panel? Representative March and Representative Berard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Newkirk, we've heard testimony that the problem of duplicates in Oregon is relatively low, although there's certainly the perception that we have to maintain a good database and good election records. In your experience, you've worked with other states. How would you compare Oregon to other states?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I believe that Oregon probably has, if not the cleanest, among the cleanest voter registration rolls in the country. Again, as Mr. Davidson indicated, you use yours a lot. You constantly have the opportunity to get your rolls cleaned by the return mails, the undeliverables that come back, and the other efforts that are undertaken. There are a few other states that have undertaken very strong efforts to create central voter registration systems. I believe they have developed very clean systems as a result of having those. And I could list states like Georgia, Kentucky, Arkansas, who have developed these systems. Some of them, the Kentucky is like a 20-year-old system, state mainframe-based. Everything is real-time, online. direct connection between the Department of Motor Vehicles registration process and the voter registration records. It's a very good process, and a lot of people don't like it because it's mainframe-based, but I look at it and say I don't particularly care whether it could be based with a 10 Lizzie. If it worked that well, then use it. So I guess I would say that I would find that in Oregon, you probably are way down at the bottom of the list or at the top of the list, depending on how you look at it, in terms of the number of errors, duplicates in your voter registration files. Let me just say that one state we worked in, we found that of their 110 election jurisdictions, 38 of them had more registered voters than they did people of voting age population. So if that helps give you some comparison of where some other states are.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Garrard.
I'm not sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure whether Mr. Newkirk or Mr. Bradbury would prefer to answer this, but what's your estimate on the price tag and the timeline?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I believe that on the price estimate that the $6.5 million figure that is being used at between $6.5 and $7 million, including the upfront money for the planning and the design work that would need to go on, that will help you narrow and determine exactly what the actual implementation cost will be when you do that detailed work. I believe those are realistic figures. And again, I strongly support the idea that before you begin the project, you make the commitment to fund that level. Now, there are numbers of ways I understand that you can do that, with potentials for matching money from the federal government and things of that nature, but I do recommend strongly that that stable multi-year funding be in place before you really start the project. I believe that piecemealing it typically does not lead to a good outcome. As far as the timeline, I believe that if you were to start soon after the conclusion of this session, it would be realistic to expect that you would have a system that would be functioning in time for the general election in 2004.
Thank you.
And then Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for Mr. Bradbury, actually. This bill was considered by this committee in the last session also, and the committee sent it out with a due pass recommendation. We really don't have a problem of support, particularly in the House. We've got more than half the House members sponsors of the bill, close to half the Senate. The problem is going to basically come down to funding. And one of the things that had been discussed in the last session was the possibility of issuing certificates of participation for the sort of hard costs of making the change. And I'd had a few short discussions with the treasurer here about, you know, is there any potential of any way to creatively fund this? And I know there's the issue about federal funds, but we all know the issue is going to be finding $6 million.
Right.
Is there going to be any ongoing effort to find a more creative way than simply trying to get a $6 million appropriation in a budget where finding a $500,000 appropriation is
important? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can't say that we're we're spending a lot of time thinking about creative ways to come up with $6 million in terms of COPs or whatever. I mean, I hadn't even heard that one. I think that the issue that I'm following the closest and have been in touch with is the issue of federal money, because it's fairly clear that there will be you never know till it's done, but it's likely there will be at least one federal bill with a fairly substantial sum of money attached that's designed to both, depending on which bill passes, designed both to help states and counties eliminate punch cards, number one, but number two, make overall system improvements. And this is an example of an overall system improvement. So, and they were talking about somewhere, I was just back in D.C. 2 weeks ago, and they were talking about somewhere in the range of $500 million to $1.5 billion being put in a congressional appropriation for these kinds of issues. So our greatest hope is to see some federal assistance to help this happen.
Mr. Chairman, follow up.
Follow up.
Mr. Bradbury, do we anticipate, I think that's been part of the discussion, that the federal money will come with matching requirements potentially?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, we would assume, and in most of the discussions with congressional leaders that took place between the Secretary of State and congressional leaders 2 weeks ago, there was a discussion, there was some assumption that there would be a state match. What level that match was, you know, who knows? But one would be safe to assume that there would be some state match with federal money of this type.
Final question, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bradbury, given the timelines and everything, it would be fair to assume that if we had a commitment for funding, we could do it over a two biennium period. Would that be, or at least a portion of it?
I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman. I'm not quite sure I understand.
You would not have to have the full appropriation or the full either federal funds or the full state matching in one biennium probably to complete the process, just a commitment to do that. It might take 3 years to complete the process. Part of it can be funded in a future biennium also.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would be concerned about that. In that, I think what Mr. Newkirk has said is that he's had lots of experience with projects where they're still looking for a third of their money, and it really leads to significant problems and cost overruns. So, what we have on the table, what is proposed in this measure is somewhere in the range of $6 to $6.5 million. The expenditure of that money would be over a longer period of time than the next biennium, but that funds the system.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you, Representative Walker.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Perhaps it is more of a suggestion than a question, Mr. Bradbury, but a lot of the counties which retain, you know, the voting records as they do now will check the obituary columns to see who has passed away against their voting records so that they don't, when they come up close to an election, have to worry about who is not necessarily around to vote anymore. And I wanted to know if there is some plan to connect the state system, if we can get this passed this time, connect the state system to where we can get those as they are recorded at the State Department of Vital Statistics, because sometimes these people, for instance, they may live in one county and they're transported to a facility in another county and they'll pass away there, and then the county where they're registered to vote doesn't even know, or some obituaries aren't even published. I'd like to know if that is in this plan or if it could be in the plan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's not specifically in this plan. And when I say that, it's not specifically in the plan that would be provided with a $6 or $6.5 million investment. It is one of the things that is possible as an add-on to the plan after we get the system up and running. Another example of that would be linking to Department of Motor Vehicles with their motor voter so that we are sure to get the registration in. I mean, there's been some difficulty with people thinking they registered at DMV and then the county doesn't get it. So that would be another example of a possibility of a future enhancement, and death records would be another thing that could be explored.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Davidson, in view of my question here with Mr. Bradbury, would it be cheaper to do it at the time the system is set up, or would an add-on like that be something that would be nominal cost later? Nominal in relation to $6 million, I guess.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, I don't know about how the cost would play into it, but I think that as we go through the design process, I think that's the kind of thing we would want to consider in this very first phase. And you are correct. Many of us in the counties do clip obituaries. We also do get the death list from state vital statistics, as well as many of us get those from our own county
vital statistics and health departments before they're even reported to state vital statistics, so we're ahead of the curve. So a lot of that is being done. I don't see this as a huge major issue, but there may be a better way of doing it.
Well, that was what I was interested in, a better way to do it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Newkirk, I wanted to ask you about the system itself and the desire of many to add options to this as we go along. Do you have any specific recommendations or ideas about what type of system to have as our first choice, the one that we really want? Is it a basic model? Is it a model with a few add-ons, a few options? Do you want to do all the add-ons at the beginning? How do you approach a project like this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I recommend that you define that base level of functionality that creates the basic technical infrastructure that you need, taking into account as many of the needs and requirements that will come from the counties, from the other stakeholders in the process, as possible within the time frame and within the budget limitations that you have going into the project. I do recommend that, as I've told Secretary Bradbury, one of the first official steps should be to create what is known in the trade as a change management database, which is another polite way of saying you put something in that you can gracefully use to tell people no with, that you keep track of all these requests as they come in. You have an official a procedure set up of a steering committee of stakeholders who review those requests as they come in, and if they have a negative impact on the schedule or on the budget, that basically they either have to be deleted in the first phase or delayed until a second phase. I think that's probably one of the most important things that can be done to avoid what is known as scope creep, which is officially what kills many of these projects. So I really recommend a core level of functionality to begin with, doing as much as you can and as you determine in the next definition phase as possible, and then everything else is essentially frozen outside that limit, and you keep very good track of what those elements are.
Thank you. Mr. Secretary, Mr. Newkirk has given us 5 precepts for a good project. And they look great. They make really good sense. And I think it's the hope of many people in this process to see this system built and built well. One of the greatest fears, of course, would be a boondoggle that would come from any number of problems developing. You know, I remember as a news reporter a couple of years ago, long before involved in the political scene, reading of a problem we had with the state DMV computers and so forth. None of us would like to see anything like that happen, you know, as time goes. Who would be responsible in state government at that point? Who would be the point person that makes sure that these 5 precepts are lived by and kept on track so that we would avoid the previously mentioned problem?
Mr. Chair, I think the Secretary, I would be, in this case, the Secretary of State would be. I think the Secretary of State relies on administrators of various divisions like the Information Systems Division. Scott Smith would be a key person to work with, but I think the responsibility rests very clearly with the Secretary.
Fine, thank you. Further questions? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I think we've got a pretty good list. Let's move on through. I'd like to have Dawn Phillips come forward.
Gingers. Administrator.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Dawn Phillips, former communications director under House Speaker Lynn Snodgrass, and I am here in her absence today and going to present you with the testimony she herself would have liked to have been here to deliver. Chair Wilson, first I want to thank Secretary of State Bill Bradbury for calling me last night and inviting me to the hearing today. Unfortunately, I was unable to clear my schedule and to join him in person for the testimony regarding the centralized voter registration system. As many of you know, I have been a strong opponent of centralized system. Part of my Voter Protection Act in the 1997 and 99 sessions put into operation a centralized system. Not only does it make good sense, but example after example from all over the state of duplication of ballots is a situation waiting for unethical people to do unethical things. The constant question has been the dollar amount to implement a statewide system. Last session, then-Secretary of State Phil Kiesling requested $7 million for the centralized system. My research showed that an accurate program could be done for less money. As the session drew to a close and final funding decisions were made, there was only $1 million left to fund centralized voter registration. I refused to allocate such an inadequate amount of money for such an important project, so those dollars were used in other areas of the budget. I urge you to consider the same decision-making process again this year. While most agree that a centralized system is critical to the accuracy of our voter files in our state, Oregonians also recognize that underfunding a computer project the size and scope of this one could result in a mess demonstrated by the Department of Motor Vehicles. We can't afford another DMV computer mess. A centralized voter system must be done right the first time. This project requires commitment by everyone. Legislators must commit to the necessity of the project and prioritize it appropriately. The Secretary of State must commit to the project and prioritize it in his budget as well. A substantial portion of the dollars needed to fund a centralized system should be found within the Secretary of State's budget, not entirely as an add-on package, but within the current operational budget. That is a true commitment. Implementation of an accurate and statewide system will take several bienniums. It will require a long-term commitment by legislators and the Secretary of State's office to accomplish this project. Chairman Wilson, you have my commitment that I will be a strong opponent of a centralized system until it is not only funded, but up and running as well. And if I can be of any further assistance, please don't hesitate to call me, and I have contact information for the former speaker if you need it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Any questions? Thank you. I'd like to take a moment to, before we go any farther, to have Fred Neal from the Secretary's office come forward to describe the amendments that were mentioned initially today.
Okay, great. Thanks, Connie.
Neal, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Fred Neal, one of the managers in the Oregon Elections Division. In consultation with Scott Smith, our IS director, we've looked at House Bill 2802 and seek some amendments which we've engrossed for you in the version you have in front of you. They are not yet drafted by Legislative Council. I will just simply summarize those amendments for you today, and we can get into them further in any subsequent work sessions. First, in Section 1, we want to make it clear that this is a joint project in partnership with the counties, who will retain ultimate responsibility for voter registration maintenance. And so we've, rather than in consultation with the county elections officials, want this project to be in conjunction with them throughout the development and implementation of periods. Subsection 2, we think that a project definition is a critical component of first defining the project and deciding what components will be in and when they'll be included and what the capabilities are and business needs are of both state and local persons. This, we believe, will take longer than the anticipated schedule 2 years ago in the original legislation. But we think that it will forfend any problems in the implementation part. You spend more time in the defining the project and developing the schedules and cost estimates before you proceed with implementation. And those are the components listed then in the amendments for a project definition. We would want in subsection 3 that the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology not only review and comment, but approve this project definition before the Secretary proceeded with the project in conjunction with the county. Then in sub 4, would proceed with the detailed project management plan once getting Joint Interim Committee approval. And then after that plan's adopted by the Secretary, developed by the Secretary, implement it no later than, as the bill says, January 31, 2004. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Neal? All right. Thanks very much. Next up, we'll have Neil Pinder, Democratic Party of Oregon, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Neil Pinder, Democratic Party of Oregon. I think we're here just really to echo many of the, add a voice to the choir of the sentiment in support of the centralized voter registration system. I actually think this is a, when we testified on the Senate side last week, our Republican colleagues, Mr. Howard, who I think is here also today, joined us, and I think this is a great opportunity for us to work in bipartisan fashion. This election really demonstrated the need for a centralized, a dynamic, updated, centralized voter registration system. The situation in Florida was certainly the spotlight was cast there, but could have easily been cast here as well. And while there have been issues raised about the concern about duplicate ballots, it is important to address those through the voter registration system, and not it's not a function of a problem with vote by mail per se. But so, if we correct voter registration through a centralized dynamic process, then we can decrease the number of duplicate ballots that are sent out. In addition to that, I think one of the things that has not been discussed is that there's practical import for the average voter. One of the big problems with this is that we've already established is cost. And it is a hefty price tag, particularly in a tight fiscal environment. However, I would argue from a political standpoint that what is the cost of not pursuing this? And I think we understand that the public has confidence in our elections has been shaken, and that's not partisan. I think that on both sides, people need to understand that when they cast their ballot, that their will and intent is fully considered, and this is a step in the right direction. And so, we would add our voice to the choir of supporting this and to fully funding it, to making sure that it happens as quickly as possible. And in consultation with the Secretary of State's office, it looks like 2004 would be the first real practical implementation of that. So we'd certainly like to advocate for that. In terms of how this impacts the average voter, because this is inside baseball to a lot of folks who deal with campaigns, we've been working with the county clerks for years, and I can only commend the work that they do. They've taken a beating recently, I think, in editorials unfairly. They have performed with tremendous grace under pressure, I think, in this last election, such a tight election and with few resources, and really did an admirable job to make sure that the highest priority was to ensure an accurate and fair vote count. But the practical implication to the public is one of the biggest complaints that we get as a political party from voters is receiving unwanted political communication after they've already cast their ballot. And by having a system that actively and dynamically updates of voter registration and of those voters who have voted, they can be removed from voter lists, which decreases costs for conducting campaigns, it diminishes the nuisance created for the average voter. So that's just one practical example of how this can, I think, be sold to the public. So with that,
thank you.
Have questions?
Thank you for your testimony.
Sure.
Next up will be Daryl Howard, Oregon Republican Party. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I just keep my comments short that we fully support this. We think it's an idea whose time has come, and I'm not sure on the price tag, but we have to do something, and we have to do it now. If we're not going to do it now, it will never happen. And I've heard a lot of comments about the DMV, and I once had a car accident. I've driven by that street corner again, and I've driven by a little more cautiously. I think there are things that we can do now in the computer age that we probably couldn't do a while back, and I think all the major parties should be included in any kind of working group. We've been working closely with Secretary of State's office on this, and for any of the specifics that we can help with for our parties, both the Democrats and Republicans and any other major party. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Howard? Thank you very much. Next up will be Kathy Eaton, League of Women Voters of Oregon, please. Welcome. Identify yourself, please.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Kathy Eaton, Government Chair for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I'm also going to be very brief. We've been supporting centralized voter registration since our members agreed that this was critical for the state in 1997 and have so testified in the last two legislative sessions. Just a couple of comments. We believe that the timeline is reasonable and within the state's ability to accomplish. We support the amendments that have been put forth by the Secretary of State and Elections Division, and we believe that the proposal offers the flexibility in what can be included that is very important. We do have some questions about the funding. It died in Ways and Means in 1999. We certainly support every effort that can be made so that that's not going to happen again. We believe that it should take place now. It's important that it take place now. We believe specifically that it provides protection and validity for our vote by mail system. And to that extent, it's even more important and for some other reasons. So whatever assistance that the League can provide in terms of helping with the approval of the support for funding it, we will be happy to try to provide, because our members and the public for which we speak are very interested in this project and want it to go forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Again, thank you very much. I will call forward Jason Williams, Taxpayers Association of Oregon, please.
Chair Wilson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Williams, Executive Director of the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. I just have three brief points. We are in support of, enthusiastic support of this single voter database system. Number one, we are constantly hearing more and more examples of people getting double ballots or a ballot in one home and then at their former home. And in fact, there was a, and we're also seeing problems with the addresses being kept up in the voter databases currently. Number two, we also think that the time that our election is most vulnerable is during the last 30 days. If you take my county, Washington County, they process on an average month anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 name changes and voter registration changes. But come near the 30 days before the election, it jumps up to 30,000. And the quicker that they can check for those duplicates, the better. And to kind of follow up on what a question Representative March had in regards to the duplicate problem here in Oregon, it is small. Last February, a bunch, about 20-some counties got together, pulled their list to a list vendor. List vendor gave each county a report on the questionable names. For this county, Marion County, they had 2,500 questionable names. They went through that whole list, found 350 duplicates. It's small compared to the 130,000 registered voters here in Marion County, or whatever that number is. But that number, we believe, will continue to grow if it's left unchecked. And then finally, with the changing atmosphere of vote-by-mail and election laws, we at the Taxpayer Association do believe that when we ask our public employees to adapt to a changing environment, that we give them the tools and the technology and the flexibility to deal with those changing atmosphere. And we feel like having a single voter database would allow them to do their job a lot quicker, save time, effort, and money in the long run and in the short run.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Williams? Representative Berger.
I have a question. Do you believe, as executive director of a taxpayers association, that this would have high priority with taxpayers?
Chair Wilson, members of the committee, yes, especially since it preserves the integrity of the whole system. We believe that taxpayers, you know, they are sitting there putting the money to fund this whole institution, and in doing so, they get to control how much of their taxes and their fees and everything is they pay into the system, and that will be lost every election cycle that we don't keep track of the duplicate and the potential for fraud on voters.
Other questions? Thank you. Steve Lanning, Oregon AFL-CIO, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Lanning. I'm the political director of the Oregon AFL-CIO. We're a federation of labor unions which represent about 175,000 working people across the state. And we support the development of a centralized voter registration system. It's definitely an important tool to ensure that citizens are not registered to vote in more than one county as they move their residence and re-register to vote in another county. And it would also help reduce the instances where a voter receives two ballots. Occasionally, with that many members, we hear stories about folks moving and getting a ballot from each county. And I myself, in the May election, received two ballots, one from Marion and one from Polk. And I had re-registered 12 days before the voter registration deadline. And I can only imagine what the county clerks go through without a centralized system trying to sort everything out using the vendors and so on. I know that it's not widespread, but it does occasionally happen. I think it would also help the county clerks in determining who's an inactive voter and when they're reactivating their voter registration status. We conducted a reactivation voter registration type of drive ourselves in Multnomah County, and I think a system like that would be helpful. And I know that revenue is limited, and I think that there's plenty of time to study this thoroughly and to pick the best options for the state of Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Do we have questions? All right, Mr. Lanning, thank you. Appreciate your time today. And a representative from Sunlight Data, please. Fred, I'm going to let you help us with your last name now, okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Fred Hewitt. My consulting name is Sunlight Data Systems. It's just me. My business partner in Corvallis is Harry Demarest, who runs Astro Research. Together, we've built and have compiled a statewide voter file since 1996 from all the counties. And for the last year, we've had that system online, available 24 hours a day through a secure web server to our clients, which include the Democrats, organized labor, environmental groups, and so forth. So we've already put together something approximating what the system would do, at least in the very basic part of it. It wouldn't have all the features that is that are contemplated in the plan that's been put forth, but it is the basic portion of, I think, what you are looking at. So what I would like to do is suggest that our interest in this is we're not real, we like the part of our work that involves helping make this data more usable to our clients. We're not particularly thrilled with the process of collecting the data from the counties and putting it together, dealing with all the inconsistencies and so forth. In fact, we're doing that right now with the results from November. The counties really do, as you've heard, a good job, but they have antiquated, sometimes antiquated systems, sometimes they've recently been updated. They have a lot of work to do. Dealing with us is not a very frequent thing for them. Public service requests for data are not very common. They provide us what they can, but those formats are not very consistent. and often not complete, and basically not as complete as we would like. It's not that they don't have the data, it's that the software that they use doesn't provide a common format that makes it easy to get the data from all the counties that we might need. In moving toward a statewide system, that issue is going to have to be addressed. What I'm here to suggest today is that we would like to see the impasse over funding broken on this issue, and I have a suggestion that you may like. This was the same that we made in 1999 before the same committee. And that would be to have a first phase of this process that would not be a real-time system, but instead would be a what you might call a batch update system. The batches could be as frequently as every day if you wanted, where the counties would be submitting data to a central file at the Secretary of State's office. It could be compiled, checked for duplicates, made available online just as we've done with our system so that it can be cross-checked. The difference is, not being a real-time system, you're not incurring the costs that come with a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week, automatically updated dynamic system. That's a significant portion of the cost in these projects. I've worked on database systems for 15 years, and those are typically the issues that you run into with leasing the phone lines, dealing with the downtime issues and so forth. That really adds to the cost, in addition to the data design parts of it. I think that we support that real-time dynamic system over the longer run, but I would hate to see the result, as we had in the last session, of getting to the point of funding and not being able to move forward in this biennium because the money just simply is not there. So I would suggest that the committee take a look at the idea of a first phase of this project that would lead toward the longer-term system, but would get us immediately underway and enable us to implement a statewide voter file, not necessarily updated every single minute, that would enable us to start looking at issues such as voter duplications, increased efficiency in managing the data throughout the counties, and improving the consistency of the data. One thing I might mention that's very important to us is the ability to receive frequent reports, preferably at least daily, from all counties about votes received during the vote-by-mail process. Neil Pender mentioned this issue. We've spent a great deal of effort trying to collect that data from the counties so that we can update our own list so that when the notification comes from the county that somebody has voted, we stop contacting them. I think this is not only a service to our clients, but also helps improve the election process. It gives people an incentive to vote early, which is a good thing, and we definitely think that the vote-by-mail system has gone a long way, but can be improved, and this is one of the improvements that we see if we were to move quickly toward implementing at least the basics of a system. So I hope this idea helps clarify that it's not an all-or-nothing proposition. I think we can take the first step forward in an affordable way. I can't give you an exact estimate. We'd have to go and ask the counties how much it would cost them to request a new file format from their vendors. But I can't imagine it being more than about 10% of the total system cost that's been laid out. Again, building out a complete system that's online all the time, that's where the real cost is. But the value, the low-hanging fruit, if you want to put it that way, could be achieved for a lot less than that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? I'd ask you briefly, what has been the receptivity of your idea to this point?
Mr. Chair, we've brought this before you in 1999, and I think at that time the notion, we had discussions with the Secretary of State's office, with the Elections Division, with others. The notion was that the idea was to really get everything funded, if at all possible, so that, as you've heard, and I would strongly support this notion, having been in the computer consulting business myself for a long time, you don't want to underfund a project like this because you'll end up with a what they call a runaway, a project that tends to be underfunded, also tends to have scope creep, tends to not be planned properly. You get cost overruns, time overruns. And in many states, not just the few that have been mentioned so far, this has been a real issue with those statewide systems. So I would say we've gotten a little bit of interest to this point in the idea, but not a whole lot, because I think generally, everybody's trying to get their arms around the idea of what a statewide system would do to begin with.
Thank you. Representative Garrard.
Is the software that you're talking about to begin initially, would that be compatible with what Mr. Newkirk was talking about earlier as part of the core system of the entire finished product?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, let me try to distinguish between software as you might use a program like Microsoft Word or Windows operating system and so forth versus the data format. The data formats
probably are going to be relatively similar in both systems. In other words, if you look at a voter record, you'll have a name, address, divided into components, street number, southwest, southeast, directional, street name, and so forth, possibly phone number, city, state, zip, the party registration, date of registration, voter history information, various other pieces of information, some of which is not public, like the signatures, the electronic signatures. That element of the system is probably going to be fairly consistent in both what I would call a short-term approach, like I've been describing, in the longer-term approach. In fact, the step of helping the counties to make their system more consistent with the statewide file is going to have to occur anyway, and probably will take some fine-tuning. I don't think that the system that the user sees necessarily has to be the same. You could read a spreadsheet in Microsoft Excel, or you can read a spreadsheet in Lotus 1-2-3. There are different programs that read the same data. So in the same sense, you could have different systems that draw on the same data, one that's in place temporarily before the full-time, full-scale system is developed.
Thank you. Any questions? All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your time today. Paul Snyder, Association of Oregon Counties, please. And this would exhaust my list as I know it, and so if there are any others who wish to testify, please be ready to do so as soon as we're through with Mr. Snyder. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. We have not taken a formal position on House Bill 2802, although we have previously supported centralized voter registration. Just one concern which I would like to raise that's been touched on before in previous testimony, but I don't think focused on by anybody, and that would be the ongoing cost of operating the system that's created. It's the implementation, the planning, other components of the system are addressed, I think, fairly well in the draft version of the bill, and I believe in the Secretary's draft amendments. But sometimes that's just the tip of the iceberg. I don't know what the ongoing operating costs of a system such as this would be, but a big aspect of the design should be considered to be the operating costs as they go on. I deal more with jails than I do with voter registration systems, and I can tell you that a rule of thumb with respect to jails is that you pay about 10% of the construction costs in operating costs every year, which means that you're paying for your jail every 10 years over and over and over again. If that's an issue, and you can design it in a way to significantly reduce those operating costs over time. So just as you see in the store appliances that show you their energy rating and tell you over what period of time it will take before you recover the capital cost of the appliance, I suspect that's also true with the voter registration system. And I'd simply recommend that the committee and the secretary and the county clerks take a close look at these operating costs, as well as the issue of how would those costs be paid, not just the cost of planning and implementation of the system, but what's it going to cost to keep it going.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, I did have
Representative Dillon.
Thank you. In the process as it's being defined in the amendment of working in conjunction with the counties and specifically probably the county clerk, and you're talking about revising the system of registration, there might be some savings, too, in terms of existing. Could that be the case also?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, yes, very much so. That could very well be the case.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Anyone else want to testify on this one? Mr. Newkirk, can we call you back for just a moment? I want to thank everybody for respecting the clock today like you have. Mr. Newkirk, a couple of follow-up questions. Mm-hmm. As long as we have you, I'd like to ask. And one of the questions I did want to ask was ongoing cost, what your experience has been in observing that, and any cost offsets that might occur as a result of adopting this system.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. We provided an initial cost estimate for the annual maintenance figures, which include staffing at the state level, as well as ongoing training costs, software maintenance, hardware maintenance. And I believe, I'm calling this one from memory now, but I believe it was approximately $1.5 million per year. The figure in the information systems industry is that you can typically expect to pay between 15 and 20% of the initial implementation cost as an annual basis. Now, that number, Mr. Chair, is subject to great variability based on the nature of the system, but that is not necessarily a bad way to look at it. It's from 15 to 20% annually. The cost offsets, a bit difficult to determine that without doing a much better product definition. However, there are some that we could at least think about. To the degree that you have your voter registration rolls cleaner, which is to say typically smaller, that would decrease your cost for printing and mailing ballots in an election. Again, a standard rule is it costs a bit less to maintain a smaller database than it does a larger database, so you do achieve some additional cost savings there. Those are the things that we can look at in somewhat detail because we know they're out there. There is another element, Mr. Chair, that was mentioned during the course of our study, and that is the potential cost of savings from non-litigation on the whole issue of the double majority to the degree that you can save. But again, that's a much less tangible figure that you could look at.
Thank you. We know that there are about 2,000 transactions per day involving registration with the department right now. And we've also heard and understand that as we approach an election, the number increases dramatically. Is there anything that we have to be careful for in the build-out of this system to be ready for what would be the highest use scenario rather than the lowest?
Yes, sir, and that's one of the reasons for doing the planning early on with a greater deal of business definition that you're going to look at. Analogy that I like to use is from the transportation industry. If you could run a bus system and you didn't have to worry about rush hour peaks, you could do it with about a third the number of buses that you normally have to use. The same thing is probably true with bandwidth, with processor capability, and with memory on computers. If you didn't have to deal with the fact that you're going to have these tremendous spikes of both data update and in particular inquiry that will go on as the buildup comes to an election, you could certainly build a much easier system. I mean, my gosh, some places you could almost do it with dial-up lines. But the reality is that you have to plan for the peaks, and the peaks and valleys in the election business are extreme.
Thank you. Does vote by mail in any way exert any pressure on the system that I'm not thinking?
I'm not sure that it exerts any pressure as much as it does just add a level of complexity and insistence upon accuracy. It simply places that requirement that you have a higher degree of accuracy than you otherwise might need to have. But the reality of it is, I think, as one person with whom I discussed this at lunch today, is you get down ultimately to the question of is what price are you willing to pay for the democracy, regardless of how you vote. The issue is you need to have clean voter registration files, and more, you need to have the public perception that the voter registration files are clean and fair.
Thank you. Further questions? Well, thanks for coming back.
Thank you.
Glad we were able to call you back. Right, that exhausts the list here of those wanting to testify, unless there's someone here that I'm not aware of. Again, thank you for your testimony today. We're waiting for the amendments to come back. I think there's a high degree of interest in this committee in getting this thing rolling. And so we'll anxiously await that and bring this back as quickly as we can. So with that said, we'll close the work session on the hearing, rather, excuse me, on House Bill 2802. Now we will open the public hearing on Hospital 2581.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me. I wanted to just tell the committee members that on, at their place, they will see from Coos County's clerk, Carrie Turi, constituent piece on this last bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Berger. Appreciate that. Okay, we've opened a public hearing on Hospital 2581, and I'd like to have Lynn Rosick, State Election Commission, come forward, please.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd ask if Vicki Irvin could join me if there are technical questions on this bill.
Sure, that would be fine. Thank you. You identify yourself, Ms. Rosick, if you would just give us a brief explanation of what this bill does.
I'd be happy to. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Rosick from the State Elections Division, and with me is Vicki Irvin, who is the Director of Elections for Multnomah County. I gave your committee administrator some section-by-section analysis of this bill so that hopefully we could go through this, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have, because these descriptions are fairly brief, and if it piques your interest, I'd be happy to discuss it in more detail. But and if you have any questions that get too technical for me, then I will turn to Ms. Irvin for assistance. House Bill 2581 is a bill that your committee graciously submitted for Secretary of State Bill Bradbury and the Association of County Clerks. The purpose of this bill is to make a variety of changes to Oregon's election laws that we consider to be relatively technical and not necessary to carry in a separate standalone bill. Sometimes we refer to this as our omnibus or our housekeeping bill. And you can certainly let us know if you think that there's anything in this bill that is too controversial for that description. But so there are things that we gather from year to year. As soon as one session ends, we start thinking of things that we should have done or maybe we missed or things like that. And so we put them all together into one bill, and that's what this is. And so unless you have any questions before I start, I'll just quickly as possible go through the different sections. There's 20. There's probably about 10 different concepts here, 10 or 12, that I'll describe to you. Section 1, the current language in ORS 247.015 says that a person needs to turn 18 before the date of the election in order to be entitled to vote, which we don't think is the correct reading of it, because 18-year-olds are allowed to vote, and if they turn 18 on election day, they should be allowed to vote. This actually was quite an issue in a few counties in this last election, because, as you know, many people wanted to vote, and the people who had the thrill of turning 18 on election day certainly wanted to vote. So we'd like to correct that to say if they turn 18 on or before election day, they can vote. Section 2 has to do with presidential electors' pledges, which was an issue last summer. Right now, the law requires that the presidential electors' pledges actually be submitted to the Secretary of State. This is sometimes challenging for the parties because at the time that these pledges by law are supposed to be submitted, many of the chosen electors are on vacation or something. It's difficult to gather those. We don't need them in our office. What we need is the names of the electors so that we can put together the ballot. And so we're suggesting that they keep those pledges with the party. Section 3, ORS 249.013. This statute is the statute that prohibits a person from being a candidate for two lucrative offices. In 1999, it was amended to forbid a single person from running for more than one position on the same district board at the same election. For instance, if there were two vacant school positions that were both at large, a person couldn't run for both school district positions. Through some inadvertence, we didn't at that time cover the prohibition on people running for more than one city office. For instance, if there were several vacancies in city office, it was felt that it was inappropriate that a person would file for each of those vacancies. So that's what that one does. Section 4 is a correction. Several years ago, the requirement that a copy of a proposed initiative measure be attached to signature sheets was deleted. And now the circulator only has to carry a copy of the measure with them, just one, even if they have many, many signature sheets that they're using. We, at that time, we did not intend that that change be made to sponsorship signature sheets. This is the 25 that you have to collect before you can even come into the Secretary of State's office to start your initiative. But that change was made, and we'd like to reinstate that, because the sponsorship sheet says, we, the undersigned, ask to sponsor this attached measure, and we want to have a requirement that at the time they're doing that sponsorship, the measure is there so that a person couldn't circulate sponsorship sheets just blankly with no attachment to a measure. Sections 5, 6, and 7 are completely related. In 1999, again, the state initiative statute 250.045 was amended in response to a United States Supreme Court opinion out of the state of Colorado that had to do with regulations on circulators. And a number of different regulations in Colorado were struck down as unconstitutional in violation of a person's First Amendment rights. And at that time, we made several changes to the state statutes to conform with the United States Supreme Court opinion. We did not make those exact changes of the exact language to the sister statutes for county, city, and district initiatives, and that's what we're asking to do today. We're not enforcing those statutes because of the advice we've received about that opinion, but we'd like to have that language taken out of the statute. Section 8, the next few statutes have to do with essentially the same theme. As you're probably aware, in May of the year 2000, a referral did pass that extended the period of time to verify state initiatives from 15 days to 30 days, which was very beneficial to the Secretary of State's office this last summer, considering the number that were filed. But extending from 15 to 30 days has created an overlap between the time schedule for the Fiscal Impact Committee and the Explanatory Statement Committees and the 30 days of verification. In other words, those committees are supposed to start before all of the initiatives are actually done, being verified. And so what sections 8, 9, and 10 do is allow the Fiscal Impact and Explanatory Committee work to begin before these measures are fully verified. They would be in the pipeline. Obviously, we wouldn't have any committee start unless the measure was undergoing verification. And that way, we would not have a problem with timing by having to wait until that initiative qualifies. So, and if one of those initiatives that was undergoing verification did not qualify, obviously those committees would cease their work. But it's simply a management issue, because we cannot wait until after the 30 days to start fiscal impact and explanatory committee work. Sections 11, 12, and 13 are all related to changing the term biennial primary election to primary election. The word biennial primary election was developed to distinguish our May primary election, which is the one we're talking about, with what we used to have as a presidential preference primary, which you'll remember we had in 1996. It was a March election in order to participate in the presidential primary system. That was repealed after that, so we did not do that in the year 2000, so there's no longer a need to use the word biennial with relation to the primary election. There's only one primary election, and it's in May of the even-numbered year. Okay, Section 14 is amendments to ORS 254.470. This is the very long statute. I think you can see there. It goes on for several pages that gives express instructions on conducting elections by mail. There are several things that this bill does. One of them is simply to move language around, and I've described it here. What we're doing is taking language instructions regarding replacement ballots and voting instructions and moving it to different locations. There is no substantive change in that move. There is a change on page 12, lines 25 to 27, with language that says that if a person receives a replacement ballot and then the county receives the replacement ballot and the prior issued ballot that no ballot be counted. And in reflecting upon this, the clerks and the elections division felt that there really wasn't any valid authority for not counting a ballot by a qualified elector. It's a different issue than whether they've voted twice on purpose and may be prosecuted for that, but that we'd change that language to say that only one ballot shall count. Sometimes what happens in these circumstances is the person can't find their ballot even though they had it all ready to take to the post office, so they think it's been lost. So they go get a replacement ballot and vote that one. Well, it turns out maybe someone else in their household found their ballot and delivered it. And so two ballots arrived. They had no intention to vote twice. They only wanted to vote once. And we don't really see any authority for not allowing them to vote once. This is also brings this in line with how it worked at polling places when people voted absentee. If a person voted absentee, and then went to a polling place and voted, that polling place vote would count, obviously, because there's no way to retrieve that ballot. And then their second ballot, the absentee ballot, would not count. Finally, the last change in this section is to the provision about people in line at 8 o'clock. And you may have been aware of that from this last election, that because of the high interest there was in the election, that there were people on line at 8 o'clock. It has always been the law, even at polling places, that if you were in line at 8 o'clock, you were considered to be in the process of voting. And they would cut the line at 8, but if you were in it, no matter how long it took to get for that line to be processed, you were allowed to vote. And in vote by mail, that has been extended to say that if you are in line at the clerk's office to receive a ballot, or you are in line at a drop site to drop a ballot, that you are in the process of voting and your vote will count. This language simply adds to say that if you are voting at a privacy booth, which is required by law to have privacy booths where people are allowed to go vote, they look like the old polling place booths, they're usually in county clerk's offices or perhaps at another drop site location, that if you're in those lines at 8 that you may vote. Now, I'll try to make it clear that where those locations are, there are election staff or law enforcement people there at 8 o'clock. So it's not as if you can just sort of decide for yourself whether you're online at 8 o'clock. And so what happens is the elections officials will send somebody out right at 8. They will put a person at the end of the line. You may have seen this if you saw television coverage of what was happening in Vicki's County this year. She did have people online. It took a long time for them to get through, but there was an officer at the end of the line, and he waited there until everyone had come in and been able to cast their ballot. So that's what that is about. Section 15 is an amendment to a statute which currently allows election officials to begin ballot preparation 5 days before election day. Ballot preparation in this case, these are the returned vote by mail ballots. What they do is once they've verified signatures, they can begin opening return identification and secrecy envelopes and essentially preparing them to run through vote tally machines. As I say, they can currently do this beginning the Thursday before an election, and some of the counties wished to have the option of beginning that 7 days before election day for the very, very high turnout elections, such as the one in November, just in order to be able to better process their workload. But I would make it clear, though, that the law does not permit any ballot to be counted, in other words, run through a vote tally machine until election day. Section 16 is amendment to ORS 250, or I'm sorry, that's a miscite there. That's 260-695, not 254. My typing error. This is a statute that says that no person can wear a political button in a polling place, which has been on the books for many, many years. The Secretary of State's office enforced this statute back in, I believe it was 1992, involving a person who wore a button into a polling place and became embroiled in litigation, which, as you can see from the citation, went all the way to the top, and we have now been told that we cannot enforce this statute. And so we've been told from the highest authority in this state, and so we need to take it off the books. So we'd request respectfully request that you do that. Section 17, 18, and 19 are all related to Section 20, basically deleting references. We're asking in Section 20 to repeal ORS 260.522. This is a statute that has not been enforced since the United States Supreme Court opinion in 1995, which we then obtained an Attorney General opinion in 1999 to confirm did apply to the statute. This is the statute that you're probably familiar with that says that if you have political material or political advertising of any sort, supposed to say the old words were paid for by, as you'll recall, and it was supposed to be at the bottom. Many people still do it, fortunately, but that is the very statute that was struck down in the case of McIntyre versus Ohio Elections Commission, where a woman was leafleting cars and did not have any identification. It was an anonymous piece. And in a very similar statute to Oregon's, Ohio tried to enforce their statute and were told that it is a First Amendment right for people to do anonymous political literature. And as I say, since this time, the Secretary of State's office, upon advice of the Attorney General, has not been enforcing the statute. And so we respectfully request that it be deleted. It's a little bit misleading to people because we do get complaints about this. You know, that people don't put political ID on, and so they find the statute on the books, and they file a complaint, and it's sort of unfortunate to have to write back and say, well, we're not permitted to enforce that statute. So I would be happy to answer any questions. Section 21, the last section, is simply transition language for when that Section 4 change would take effect.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Garrard.
Lynn, Section 14, page 12, the people waiting in line to vote, anybody in line?
Yeah.
I did have a constituent ask me after the election that if they mailed their ballot on the Thursday before election as per instructions, what assurance do they have that that ballot arrived by 8 o'clock on Tuesday? How do you address that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, well, I mean, in fact, they wouldn't know unless, as some people do, and I'm certainly not saying they have to, they sent it certified mail or some other receipt way. We have not heard of people having issues with first-class delivery within the state, of having a problem with that kind of lead-out time. What we have heard that people do if they are concerned about their ballots arriving on time through the mail is that they can call and confirm with the county that the ballot has arrived. And that gets back to the issue that I brought up, that the other discussion that I had about replacement ballots, that sometimes if a person called on Monday or maybe even Tuesday and the county said, oh, we haven't seen your ballot yet, maybe it's in a giant stack they haven't processed yet, but we haven't seen it. That is sometimes a situation where if a person was really determined to vote and was fearful that that ballot wouldn't get there on time, they might ask for a replacement ballot, which would get us into the situation I was just talking about, that that you might actually have two ballots from that person. And it's not because they're trying to vote twice. They just are really trying hard to vote once. But to your question about, this only applies to a person who is delivering their ballot in person. It doesn't apply to the mail situation. For the mail, the law is clear that it has to arrive in the clerk's office by 8 o'clock on election night.
Thank you for the questions. Representative Gardner.
Just one quick question in relation to the mail. Do you have any idea how many ballots do arrive around the various 36 different counties the day after election or within the week after election that don't get counted?
Chair Wilson, Representative Gardner. I don't know that. I'll make one point, and then I'll ask maybe if Vicki has a better feel for this, but I would want to indicate that if a person has their ballot delivered to any of the 36 counties, it's as good as voting within their county. I hope all the committee members understand that, so that if you were someplace else or dropped it in the wrong drop site or anything, as long as it's in any county clerk's hand in Oregon by 8 p.m., it will be counted in their appropriate county. It's a transfer issue, and those ballots are counted later because it takes a while for them to get to the right place. But ask your question about how many arrive late. I guess I would ask Vicki if you have any thoughts on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, Vicki Irvin, Director of Elections in Multnomah County. We did not count, per se, although we still have them, so we could go back and count. But I would guess that all told, because ballots continue to come in amazingly for several weeks, there are probably fewer, maybe significantly fewer than 2,000 that came in Multnomah County for close to an 80% turnout. That's a very, very small percentage. What we do is we work very hard to make sure that voters understand that we do have to receive them, so it's an education sort of thing. That's why you'll hear us say to voters, if it's Thursday and you haven't voted, it's maybe best to deliver it. The other thing is that we will give credit to the post office because they are very, very cooperative, and on election day, internally, they will do a sweep of the post office, and any ballot that they find for any county in Oregon, we are right there at 8 p.m., and they will give us all of those ballots, so that helps get those last-minute ones for people who didn't heed our advice about not mailing their ballot toward the end. And that has helped reduce the numbers. Our numbers, when we had absentees in polling places, used to be much higher, but it's getting lower.
Just one last one I might on the same subject. But nobody keeps the numbers in any of the counties as far as how many have come in later than it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, we don't keep that statistic. They're not considered to be cast ballots since they didn't arrive on time. If you were interested in that, we could make an inquiry, I suppose, and just ask the counties to at least estimate as best they could as to how many were received late. It does happen. It does happen that ballots do come in late, but I think Vicki's indication is that the numbers are relatively low as a percentage of overall turnout.
No, I realize they're very low. I guess my point is that in the future it could certainly be used as perhaps a motivational tool that mm-hmm. X amount of ballots mm-hmm. were cast and didn't count in the last election because people mailed them so late. And, you know, if people realize that there were a significant number across the state that didn't, perhaps they would mail them in a little bit earlier.
Thank you. I'll get to you, those who really want to talk here in a moment. Vice Chair Devlin has something he wants to add on that.
I think in our previous discussion on this issue and when we had a general discussion at the beginning of the session, this issue came up in my understanding at that time. Clarify if I'm wrong. You still have to retain the ballots for whatever time you have to retain ballots for, even though you did not count them. So the counties would still all have those ballots that had arrived. So.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
Yes, in reference to Section 16. With the process that we have today in voting, would you describe for me where is the polling place?
Chair Wilson, Representative Berger, I'd be happy to. You're entirely right that we don't have polling places in the traditional sense. The way we've interpreted the use word polling places, it's used in the election statutes now. The polling places where ballots are issued, so each county has one, which is the county elections office. So to the extent that this statute still applied, if we were enforcing it, it would be enforced within the county elections office.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have such representatives, Sean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for doing such a thorough job in explaining this bill. It's good. You get a clear picture of what we're doing here. So thank you for that. I do have one question, though. And that's on page 1, on line 10, where you're deleting 5 words. It's unclear to me the reason why, and this wasn't in your explanation.
Okay. Chair Wilson, Representative Starr, thank you for allowing me to point that out, because I didn't when I was explaining it. And on line 10, the words complete the residence requirement or are being deleted. As we know, to be registered in Oregon, you have to be a resident of Oregon, which is encompassed in the term otherwise qualified person. You have to be a resident. But the complete the residence requirement is hooked in, and that is very old language, I believe, that's hooked in to a provision in the Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, which if you're not familiar with, as a matter of fact, there's several bills to take it out this time. Has a durational residence requirement to be a registered voter in Oregon. It has not been enforced for at least 30 years because there was a United States Supreme Court case that struck down durational residency requirements.
so that the law, as interpreted by the United States Supreme Court, is that as soon as you become a resident in Oregon, which could be the day that you arrive with your moving van, you may register to vote if you have that requisite intention to remain and that you consider Oregon your residency. So we have no durational requirement, so it is it's just cleanup language to take out complete the residence requirement, because we don't have any period of time for which you must be a resident in Oregon. You may register the day that you become a resident.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, how does that tie into, don't we have like a 20-day cutoff, a 21-day cutoff to register?
Yeah, to register and vote.
It's unclear to me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, well, we do have a cutoff. That's right, that you do have to be registered more than 20 days before the election to be entitled to vote in that election. But that is a separate thing, I think, from the durational requirement that you can't even register to vote. It's sometimes people think, oh, then you can't register in the 20 days before an election. Of course you can register. You might not be entitled to vote in that election. But you can always register. They might not process your registration right away if they're too busy. So this is a separate issue, is how long do you have to be here in the state before you can register to vote? You don't have to be here any particular period. You may register the first day.
That's fair. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And when it comes to, back to Section 1 here, on the 18-year-old issue,
mm-hmm.
Then someone can register prior to the election if they will be 18 on that election day.
Yes, Mr. Chair. There's actually, yes, that is one of the ways that you can register actually before you wouldn't be personally eligible to vote on the day that you registered because you weren't 18 yet. But if you will be 18 before Election Day, or if this law is changed on or before Election Day, you may register in advance. We have a similar provision if you are about to become a citizen, but you won't become a citizen until after the cutoff. We permit you to register in advance, and then later the documentation follows, you are a citizen, then you may vote. So basically this is just to permit people who are sort of in that little window where they're going to turn 18 after the cutoff, but by Election Day they can vote.
Thank you. Further questions? All right, thank you. My intention is to bring this bill back Friday. I want to give all of you an opportunity just to digest what you've heard, and the intention is to bring this back Friday and work it with the intention of passing it. So take a look at it. Let me know if you have any problems with it before we get there. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2581. I want to say to the committee, we have cookies here today, and they have been prepared by our own committee administrators, so they passed the X-ray test. The
very
test.
Good.
Okay.
Very
they
good.
Are excellent.
Yeah. Oh, and Representative March has tried one, he says they're excellent.
Right.
I tried too many, and they were
excellent. I have to confess, I tried more than
to be honest,
have you ever